Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are five agencies that regulate banks in this country, but only one of them actually is a bank. We'll spare you the pop quiz and give you the answer. Today, the Federal Reserve finally got serious about subprimes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 18th of December today. And a very rough look at the calendar shows that we are now about 4 months into the subprime era. We've heard from Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke intermittently during that period, mostly him telling us the crisis would be contained. That has proved not to be the case. So today, the Fed Board of Governors endorsed some new rules to protect home buyers from shady lending practices. The proposed regulations are expected to apply to new loans from all kinds of lenders, not just banks. But critics are wondering where the Fed's been since August. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
In the Fed's brave new world, certain buyers could pay off their loans early without facing a huge penalty, and they'd know exactly what they'd be paying in insurance and property taxes. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke issued a statement saying, "Unfair practices have no place in our mortgage system." Brave words, but did they come too late?
We think that the proposed rules by the Fed are, frankly, somewhat disappointing.
Ellen Schlomer of the Center for Responsible Lending says the Fed should have stopped the subprime party much earlier.
When the housing market is thriving, when house prices are going up, it's easy to plan for the good times. And unfortunately, there were a lot of indicators of upcoming problems that I think that it was just too convenient to ignore.
Schlomer says bills in Congress are tougher than the new Fed rules. Congress would empower borrowers to sue crooked lenders. But former Fed economist Ken Cutner says the Fed figured the subprime partiers didn't need a nanny.
The people doing this were all grown-ups, and the Fed's assumption was that the people who are actually making these kinds of loans are in a better position to judge their quality than we are.
Fed defenders also say, look at the result of the subprime bash, more homeowners. But Schlomer warns there'll be a hangover.
Long-term, we're going to find out that more people lost their home because of subprime loans than actually became first-time home buyers.
The public has 2 months to comment before the rules are finalized. That probably won't be a party for the Fed. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Fed wasn't the only group in Washington changing the rules today. As had been widely expected, the Federal Communications Commission voted to relax its regulations on media ownership. 32 years ago, the FCC ruled broadcasters couldn't run a newspaper in the same city as their TV station. Now they can, in the country's top 20 media markets anyway. The commission tried to do something similar 4 years ago, but lost in court. And Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports now we probably haven't seen the last of this decision either.
FCC Chairman Kevin Martin argues that in the age of the Internet, there are more news sources than ever before. And Martin says allowing media cross-ownership will in fact rejuvenate the faltering newspaper business. Media analyst Ken Doctor says he's probably right.
Well, this guy gets it better than the publishers and the local broadcasters. The news industry is struggling, and they need to embrace a multimedia platform.
But Doctor says it isn't the FCC's job to make decisions that could bolster a struggling industry. He also thinks media companies are likely to slash staffs and coverage rather than expand them as a result of relaxed ownership rules.
What it sets up is the likelihood of mergers and roll-ups.
Andrew Schwartzman of the Media Access Project agrees. He says the FCC fell sway to lobbying by big media companies at the expense of the public interest.
If these rules are upheld in court, it will mean that in large and small communities alike, the diversity of voices will be diminished.
Groups like Schwartzman's are likely to go to court to block today's change in the rules. 25 senators say they'll fight it, too. Meanwhile, consumer groups are applauding another of the FCC's decisions to cap the number of homes one individual cable company can serve at 30%. It's believed that's likely to open up burgeoning competition from phone companies and others who want to offer television service. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
The federal government's 2008 fiscal year can be summed up in a mere 1,482 pages. The House passed the massive spending bill last night. The Senate is expected to do the same thing today, and the odds are the president is going to sign it. The bill funds 14 cabinet agencies and the war in Afghanistan. It's worth about $516 billion, and it has 9,000 congressional earmarks in it. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson has this holiday spending tale.
Tis the week before Christmas in the Senate and House, and there are goodies for all, right down to the mouse.
Some sugar plums for special interests and some members that they can take home and tell their constituents about.
That's Steve Ellis of Taxpayers for Common Sense. He's talking about the thousands of earmarks or pet projects in the giant spending bill. They include $500,000 for the Streetscape Improvement Project in Bennington, Vermont. Scott Murphy directs economic development there.
You know, I wouldn't say that it's tremendously, drastically needed, but certainly it's another stepping stone going towards where we're going.
And then there's the $705,000 for brown tree snake management in Guam. Zoologist Gordon Rada with the U.S. Geological Survey says the money will help prevent the snakes from migrating to Hawaii. They'd bite, he says, and would scare tourists. Plus,
the snakes crawl on wires, and it shorts out the electrical systems.
A lot of earmarks are actually like that, where you look at it and you dig deep, you can find some justification.
Once again, Steve Ellis of Taxpayers for Common Sense.
But that is a perfect example of where we need to be trying to decide this on merit. Maybe the brown tree snake and eradication should deserve millions more than it's getting, but it doesn't because it's going through the earmark process.
Meaning at the last minute, lawmakers swipe the national credit card for their favorite causes, leaving watchdogs little time to sort through it all. Otherwise, Ellis says, plenty of these projects would get less money or none at all. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Goldman Sachs announced some tidy quarterly profits this morning. The European Central Bank pumped $500 billion into the world's credit-challenged economy. And yet, Wall Street really couldn't make up its mind. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When it's not worried about the subprime meltdown, which is most of the time, the Federal Reserve concentrates on inflation. Chairman Bernanke and the gang are known to get uneasy if core rates rise much above 2% or so. There are a lot of reasons prices here go up, of course. One of them is rising prices elsewhere. And increasingly, that elsewhere is China. We've got Marketplace's Scott Tong on the line from Shanghai for a Chinese inflation primer. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Kai. Happy holidays.
And to you, too. So give me the tour of your budget. What do you spend money on a daily basis?
Every day, I buy lunch out here in China. Now, it may sound a little trivial, but here in China, you don't mess with the lunch hour, right? You don't mess with the government. You don't mess with the lunch hour. So every day between about 11:30 and 2 o'clock, you know, China Incorporated basically shuts down. Everybody leaves the office and they go and they buy lunch or they go to a restaurant and they start talking about how stuff is getting more expensive. You go out and turn left, the guy who sells the steamed dumplings, they're 11 cents now instead of 10 cents. The woman, if I go the other direction, she sells the fried dumplings, and they're 7 cents instead of 6 cents anymore. For a lot of people, this is real money. When they go to the grocery store, when they buy pork, cooking oil, eggs, it's a big conversation now.
All right, well, here comes the obvious question. How come?
A few things going on here. Some of it is global economy stuff. You know, grain prices around the world are going up and the cost of energy to ship the stuff around the world is going up. But there are a couple factors that are unique to China here. And a big one is the fear that the car is going too fast and the engine is overheating here in China. there's too much cash in the system here, right? China exports stuff, gets money in return. The banks are lending money. There's too much of that sloshing around in China. And so the fear is it'll push prices of everything up, you know, not just the dumplings. But China's working really hard to slow it down. And so far, not too many signs that it's working yet.
Well, what if, though, Beijing doesn't quite get it right and they can't engineer, I won't even call it a soft landing because it's got so far to fall, but if they can't engineer something like a slowdown in inflation?
The fear in Beijing is instability. And here's the scenario that the woman who works in the factory, you know, sewing a shirt that you and I are going to buy, who makes 50 cents an hour, you know, her buying power goes down because of inflation. And then her parents back in the countryside who are on the farm making even less than that are seeing the same problem. And they see their bosses driving these BMWs around, you know, the big bosses who own the factories. And then you have this anger that kind of bubbles up. Rising food prices and inflation were a part of 1989, what they call the Tiananmen incident here in China. It was a trigger next door in Burma a few months back with these protests, which turned deadly in Burma. So they know that this is something that can be really sensitive kind of on the street in China. And so they're worried about that.
Frame this for me in the larger sort of global context. We have talked, you and I, about what's called the China price, China's ability to provide goods and in some cases services at a price that really other countries can't beat. Is inflation, domestic inflation there, going to change that?
It's starting to change already. We've talked on the show about how China for years had been exporting deflation, right? Pushing down the prices of stuff that we buy. Running shoes, when I went out and bought running shoes back in the States, it seemed like I paid the same or even less when I replaced them. And that was the point of the China price and exporting deflation. Well, the magic may be over. For a lot of manufacturers in China, they're seeing wage pressures going up. They're seeing raw material costs going up. You know, the RMB, the currency here in China, is kind of going up. And all that pushes up manufacturing costs, and they're starting to pass that on to the people who buy stuff in China. So next Christmas, when we're buying stuff to put under the Christmas tree, we may finally start paying a little bit more, at least the stuff that's made here in China.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in our Shanghai Bureau. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai. Thanks.
The holiday shopping season has been a tough sell so far. Sales at department stores and some other big retailers have been lackluster at best. But as we head into the crucial last week before Christmas, Stacey Vanek Smith tells us some stores just might have found a way to help shoppers get their groove on.
Used to be, a trip to the department store sounded something like this. But this year, things sound a little more like this. Busy Saturday at an upscale mall in Los Angeles. Cusp, a Neiman Marcus-run chain for young women, has a DJ playing in the store. A few steps away at Bloomingdale's, another DJ spins his stuff in the men's department. There's a DJ at makeup store Sephora and another at the MAC store. Russ Patrick heads up the Cusp stores for Neiman Marcus. They bring in DJs twice a month.
You can watch the customers walk across the street, walk from the other side of the mall, because they see that there's something going on.
Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst for market research firm NPD Group. He says even traditional retailers are waking up to the fact that a major chunk of their business is coming from minors.
Department store, they couldn't even find their way out of a paper bag when it came to trying to market to the teen sector. That is the fastest growing segment in the department store world.
A lot of other worlds, too. Young consumers spent nearly $180 billion last year. And while most Americans are expected to spend about 2.5% less this holiday season, teens are expected to spend 2.5% more. Cohen says that's got retailers going all out to woo young shoppers.
It creates a lot of challenges to really keep that consumer engaged.
But why DJs? Why not just pipe in the power pop? Neiman Marcus's Russ Patrick says DJs create a kind of happening in the store and act as atmosphere control.
Well, the best DJs are those that can really read the crowd, can be part of the shopping experience, are constantly tailoring the music to who's in the store at any given time.
Lee Dyson is spinning at the Gap. He runs Hey Mr. DJ, a group of LA DJs. Dyson says retail now makes up about 20% of his business, and it's still growing. He says that's because good DJs do more than just spin records. They actually make sales.
You're always looking for clues, body language, how they're picking clothes, or you can watch to determine how long somebody's staying in a store. Ideally, if the music increases someone's time in the store by even 5 or 10 minutes because they're hearing some of their favorite songs, the likelihood of a purchase is higher.
Dyson says 80s music is a good bet when it comes to broad appeal, and the music approach seems to be working.
I think it just gets you in the shopping spirit.
You want to stay in the store longer if it's a good song.
Of course, most youngsters are with their parents, and all that loud music could cut the shopping day short, right?
I don't shop with my parents. Sorry.
Right. In Los Angeles and feeling really old, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, a soup company CEO thinks back to his salad days.
I had a headband line from where my headband had been, and I was wearing brown earth shoes. And about 3 weeks later, I had the Brooks Brothers look.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 0.5% today, 65 points to close at 13,232. The NASDAQ picked up 0.8%, 21 points to close at 2596. The S&P 500 rose 0.5%, 8 points there to end the day at 1453. Profits for Adobe Systems exceeded expectations. Shares of the software manufacturer processed a 2.75% gain. Oil company Hess bubbled up more than 6%, and ConocoPhillips guzzled a 2% gain after analysts upped their forecast for crude oil in the coming year. Lovely. Strong quarterly earnings weren't enough to prop up Goldman Sachs. Its shares tumbled almost 3.5% today. Bonds traded pretty much flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note held at 4.12%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative, and if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The latest Reuters Zogby Index results are released, measuring American voter sentiment. The House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming holds a hearing on the recent climate conference in Bali. And on December 19, 1958, Earth received a Christmas greeting from space. U.S. satellite Atlas transmitted a recorded message from President Eisenhower, the first radio voice broadcast from space. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
I read today that even in this age of email, the number of actual letters sent to Santa Claus is expected to be up this year. We are quite a ways from the North Pole here at Marketplace, but we've gotten quite a few holiday-themed letters, too. A commentary last week about the many gift cards that go unredeemed this time of year drew a response from Providence College marketing professor Dan Holm. He says recent studies have ignored some of the biggest users of those cards.
If you go to the mall on December 26th, you're going to see lines of kids up at 9 o'clock. Now, when is a kid up at 9 o'clock on a non-school day? It's because they're driven to the mall by those gift cards. They want to redeem them.
If you're looking for the ultimate gift this year, the plug-in hybrid may not be it.
We told you a couple of weeks ago that the plugin hasn't really taken off yet. Ian Miller of San Diego, California, wrote to mention the bit players in the sustainable car game.
I think that the smaller companies are fulfilling that niche of plug-in hybrids and advanced technology that the larger car manufacturers have largely ignored.
Another theme this December has been the eco-friendly holiday. Last Friday, you heard what might well have been the first ever Marketplace holiday arts and crafts session.
Get a potato, cut it in half, and then you're going to want to take a knife and carve an image into there. Put your potato down in the paint and then just start stamping.
Amanda Statz of Jersey City, New Jersey, says that at the very moment she heard that story, she was doing her part to save the planet.
I was shoving cookie cutters into potato halves to make stamps for wrapping paper.
And finally today, speaking of a green Christmas, our choice of music for the crafts story drew a bunch of letters from you.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
We chose Frank Sinatra from a 1944 recording just to be different, but many of you rightly pointed out White Christmas is Bing Crosby's signature song. So here's some Bing, just to make up for it.
Where the treetops glisten and children listen.
And we'll let Elvis, my personal favorite, take us out.
Mild days,
whatever color your holiday is, you know how to reach us. Our website is marketplace.org. And thank you very much. Good soup days are few and far between here in Los Angeles, but today is a perfect one. It's wet and cold in Southern California. Worse, really, in much of the rest of the country. Probably just the kind of day that executives at the Campbell Soup Company dream about. But 6 years ago, Campbell's was feeling anything but warm and cozy. Market share was down. The stock price was falling. Those red and white cans were practically gathering dust on supermarket shelves. So the board decided to bring in turnaround specialist Doug Conant as the new CEO.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, a visit to Campbell's headquarters in Camden, New Jersey. When we talked earlier this month, I asked Doug Conant how the world's biggest soup company had forgotten how to actually sell soup.
Well, this company was trapped in what a friend of mine calls the circle of doom. In fact, it was the poorest performing food company in the world from 1997 to 2001.
When the headhunter called to talk to you about this job, what was your gut reaction?
I was excited about it. I was excited.
In a nowhere to go but up kind of way or in a...
No, I've worked in the food industry for the better part of my adult life, over 30 years. And this is an icon company with icon brands and all the fundamentals required to be successful. The company, like many other companies, had simply lost its way. We had been compared to a buggy whip by a leading analyst, basically talking about how our core soup business had lost its relevance with consumers and might go the way of the buggy whip if we didn't get it in gear and really focus on committing ourselves to revitalizing it.
You did that in large part by letting people go and reassigning people.
It was a massive change. We were in a tailspin. We had a level of competence that was required to dig out of the hole. People needed to get up to that level of competence. If they couldn't, we'd help them find a role in the organization or outside the organization where they could succeed.
You come across in person as a very nice, calm, measured individual. Is there a little bit of bureaucratic knife fighter in you?
I wouldn't characterize it that way, but what I would say is I'm known around here as being very tough on standards, but being tendered with people.
How long did it take before you felt comfortable that you were on the right track?
It took us the better part of the first 3 years to get on track.
So fully half your time here so far.
We had a lot of organization resetting to do and a lot of changes that had to be made, and then we had to demonstrate that we could move the company forward. I honestly believe soup is just going to be a great growth engine for this company for the next several decades.
Why?
Why? Because it's such a core behavior, not just in the United States, but really globally. Every culture, soup is one of the oldest foods they have. After they would slay the woolly mammoth, they would boil the bones and make soup. It's before bread. It's before any other prepared food. It's meat, vegetables, soup.
Why has it taken so long, then, for Campbell to get overseas to some of the great soup-eating cultures in this world? And I'm thinking now specifically of China and Russia.
We are the world's largest soup company, and we only compete in countries that represent 6% of the world's soup consumption. Russia and China alone represent 50% of the world's soup consumption. So there's a huge opportunity there.
So explain to me, for example, how in Russia, where you have everybody from young men to grandmothers making soup at home from freshly bought materials in the store, you're going to go in there and sell them prepackaged soup.
Well, we help them start the soup experience. Our plan in Russia is all about helping the person making the soup make it faster and better. All we do in Russia, our proposition, first of all, they consume soup six times a week. They make soup twice a week. They make the broth for about 3 hours, and then they put the fresh ingredients into the soup. Our entry in Russia is focused on helping them make the broth. We're not trying to replace the soup habit.
It was a near thing, you getting into consumer packaged goods or becoming a professional tennis player. How did it come to pass that you're not out there with the
that
guys
wasn't
on the court?
I wasn't a very good player. That solved the problem. The lifestyle of a professional athlete was just challenging, and I was more built to work in the corporate world. When I started my first day at work, I started at General Mills 32 years ago, and I'd come right off playing tennis. And I remember my first day at work, I started in a khaki suit with a bright yellow shirt, a big wide Madras tie. I had long hair and a Fu Manchu mustache, and I had a headband line from where my headband had been, and I was wearing brown earth shoes. And about 3 weeks later, I had the Brooks Brothers look,
yeah.
And I had made the shift. But I love the work in corporate America. I love working with people, all kinds, sizes and shapes. It's been a thrilling ride.
Doug Conan is the president and CEO of the Campbell Soup Company. Mr. Conan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You can see what Doug Conant looks like without that Fu Manchu, and you can hear some conversations from other corner offices, too. Just go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, it wasn't all subprimes and budgets in Washington today. Congress decided to keep the government in the terrorism insurance business. Minus copays and deductibles, federal aid for bombings and officially declared terrorist attacks will kick in when damage is assessed at more than $100 million. Analysts guess 2 out of every 3 American businesses have some kind of coverage. The president has said the White House will probably sign the bill after being unable to convince Congress to create a private terrorism insurance market. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow bumped up 65 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ added 21 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 hiked 8 points. That is 0.5% there as well. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, words that'll haunt you.
I didn't read very much about the loan because I'm assuming it's going to be a good loan.
Oh, don't do that. Bad loans and subprime scams. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.